Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable. Changing their life forever so they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his April 28th press conference, President Bush promised all Americans Social Security benefits he called equal to or greater than the benefits seniors get today. Democrats have scorned Bush's Social Security plan, but they pointedly have not offered a counter-proposal. Tonight, we'll hear from MIT economist Peter Diamond about a plan he says Democrats and Republicans should embrace. This hour, On Point, an alternative path to fixing Social Security. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where the Senate returned today from a week-long recess. Still on the table, the vote on the John Bolton nomination for U.N. ambassador and the looming showdown over controversial Bush judicial nominees, like Texas Judge Priscilla Owen. Democrats say they'll filibuster on judges. The GOP may try to block that path with the so-called nuclear option. Charles Babington is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him to describe the level of tension on Capitol Hill as Congress returns from recess.
There's definitely a sense of ratcheting up, Tom. Today is the fourth anniversary of the original nominations of Priscilla Owen, among others. She still has not received a confirmation vote because of the Democratic-led filibuster, so Republicans are having a good time reminding everyone about this at every chance. There's literally almost nonstop press conferences, speeches, events all day long, and there's just a sense that this thing is going to come to a head. If not this week, in the next week or the week after that, before the month is out.
What's determining the timetable on which we might get to this moment of the nuclear option being exercised, the filibuster being put to bed on the judicial front?
Probably more than anything else is pressure from outside groups. Certainly conservative groups are pressing the Majority Leader Bill Frist to get something done. And, Tom, the clock that's ticking is really the Supreme Court. Almost everybody expects William Rehnquist to step down at the end of this term, which is the end of June. And there's a feeling among a lot of people that they want this filibuster issue settled before that vacancy occurs. And if it is settled in the way Frist wants it to, that would give President Bush more leeway in picking a conservative nominee who would need only 51 Senate votes instead of 60.
Democrats have threatened to bring Senate business grinding to an extremely slow crawl, if not a halt. Is there business that Frist would like to see taken care of before that might come?
Yes, and first of all, we should note that Democrats have had to modify. What you just said is exactly the way they have phrased it in the past, but more recently, I think they've realized that that might not play very well with the public, and they've tried to modify that a bit and say, well, you know, things that are urgent for the country, for the troops in Iraq, that sort of thing, that they would let that through, I think. But before you get to that, you're right, the highway bill is on the floor, the supplemental spending bill. There are some things that a number of interest groups would like to get done before the really bad partisanship happens.
Is it clear that with the Republicans' 55-seat majority in the Senate, Bill Frist has the 51-seat majority that he would need to change these rules on the filibuster?
It's not at all clear, and that's what's so fascinating here, Tom. At least three Republican senators have pretty much said they will not vote for the nuclear option. That puts him down to just 52.
Those three are who?
Those three are Lincoln Chafee, Olympia Snow, and John McCain.
So Rhode Island, Maine, and Arizona then.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And three Republican senators with quite a history of being independent and moderate. And then there's a number of senators, three, four, five, six, who just will not say, at least publicly, and perhaps not to Frist, how they would vote. And I think that's the real dilemma, is that Republicans seem to think if Frist really needs to bear down on these people, he probably could get their vote. But if they will not tell him that in advance, it's quite possible he would have to roll the dice when he calls for the roll call and not being 100% sure that the votes are there.
So push the nuclear button and have nothing happen. Of course, Bill Frist is seen as a very likely contender for the presidency in the next go-round, 2008. How much is riding on this for him?
He certainly is thinking about the presidency. If you're going to get the Republican nomination for president, you're going to have to be in good standing with a lot of conservative groups because they're the activists in that primary, just as liberals are in the Democratic primary. So the thinking is he at least has to try this, and he probably has to succeed if his presidential ambitions are going to be able to move forward.
A couple of other things quickly, Charles. The nomination of John Bolton to be U.N. ambassador, a lot going on in that in recent weeks. Where does that stand now?
Well, what it stands, the big day to watch for, Tom, is Thursday. The Foreign Relations Committee, Senate Foreign Relations Committee, will have a long, long hearing, probably all day. First thing that will happen is there will be a lot of discussion about new allegations that have come out, you know, over the last few weeks when part of the time Senate was in recess, and the staffers of that committee have been interviewing people and that sort of thing. And the goal is to vote at that same meeting, up or down, on whether to send him forward. So the thinking is it's not clear that anything really new has come out, and they expect a very close vote in that committee.
But Richard Lugar, chairman of the committee, saying he thinks he'll have a straight-line Republican vote that will bring it to the floor. Does that mean John Bolton's effectively on his way to the U.N.?
Well, more likely than not. And then there's one other wrinkle in that the White House signaled some time ago that, look, even if we can't get a majority on the committee, there still is a way you can bring a nomination to the floor without a recommendation from the committee. And they were trying to show that they would have a majority on the Senate floor. It so happens that an unusual number of Republican moderates happen to be on that committee. So that was a way, really, of putting pressure on those committee members to say, look, if you're thinking about opposing him, you're fighting a losing battle because we're going to win it on the floor anyway, so you might as well just play ball here. Unclear whether that's going to work.
And finally, on Social Security, what's happening there? The Republicans have been taunting the Democrats, saying we've put our proposal out. What have you got to offer? Are the Democrats showing anything on this?
So far, they're not, Tom. You're exactly right, and Democrats still feel that the public sentiment is with them, that the majority of Americans don't feel that the program is in crisis, and they're not crazy about the way to deal with the solvency issue is you raise taxes and or cut benefits, and the Democrats aren't eager to jump on that either, so they just seem to be standing pat.
And does that work on Capitol Hill, I guess I'd say?
Well, we're going to find out, I guess. I think Democrats so far feel that it is working, that, you know, they are clearly running a risk of being seen as obstructionists and do-nothings and people with no ideas, but they feel that the ideas that the president has put forward are so unpopular that it's better to just oppose those and keep insisting that the personal accounts be taken off the table.
And, of course, a decade ago, it was Republicans when there was a health program on the table who just said no, and when deficits were being attacked, who went after those increased taxes, I guess. Charles Babington, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Babington is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. President Bush says he has a solution to help fix Social Security. He's embraced the ideas of investment executive Robert Posen, who joined us last week to describe his 70% solution to the Social Security solvency challenge. Democrats don't like it because of its private accounts and large benefit cuts for the middle class, and because it leaves 30% of the anticipated hole unfilled. But the Democrats have not offered an alternative. One plan waiting in the wings, put forward by MIT economist Peter Diamond and Peter Orszag at the Brookings Institution, has gotten a good deal of attention. By cutting benefits, though less than under Posen's plan, and increasing payroll taxes, Diamond and Orszag say they have a 100% solution to fixing Social Security. More realistic, they claim, and more fair. Tonight on Point, an alternative plan for Social Security reform. You can join the conversation. Are you tuning in yet to get the details on Social Security fixes? Are you focused on how proposed changes would affect you, your kids, America's poor? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Peter Diamond. He's a prominent economist and institute professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's testified before Congress on Social Security and is co-author of Saving Social Security, A Balanced Approach. Peter Diamond, it's wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you. Welcome.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Diamond.
Peter Diamond, great to have you here. Now, we talked with Robert Posen last week, and he laid out for us the ideas he's put forward. The Bush camp says that their ideas, their plan is similar to Robert Posen's. He's seen as the sort of driving thinker behind what they're putting forward. You've got an alternative way, and let me just ask right off the bat, why do you think we need an alternative way? President Bush says Robert Posen's way looks great.
In 1983, when we had the last major reform, it took both parties to agree to it, because a reform is going to inflict pain on some people, and if one party does it alone, the other party will beat up on them. The only way we're going to get a solution is a bipartisan one. In 83, representatives of President Reagan and Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill worked out a compromise that they were both comfortable with. The major issue was how much of the change should come through new revenues, how much of the change should come from cutting benefits. I think we won't get any legislation now until we reach the same kind of point, a point where both sides are willing to put on the table what it would take for a compromise.
Why shouldn't the Democrats just step up and go with Posen's plan?
Posen's plan doesn't do the job. You indicated that it only covers part of the deficit, but that's only part of the story. The president has come out in favor of boosting benefits for low earners, which is a terrific thing to do and part of our plan. The president has come out for protecting the benefits of disabled workers, a terrific thing to do and part of our plan. You fold the need to finance those in, and Posen's down from 70% to 60%. But that's not the big deal. The big deal is the individual accounts. The individual accounts pull the money out of Social Security. If you do the Posen plan and the president's individual accounts, the trust fund runs out of money in 2030 instead of 2041. They make the problem worse. And they say, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. Somehow, the money will appear. I don't think we want Social Security to rely on somehow.
So you're saying there's another shoe to drop in the Posen-Bush plan that just isn't articulated, just isn't laid out?
Well,
they're going to need more revenue, or they're going to need more benefit cuts.
Well, they certainly need that to restore actuarial balance with the Posen plan without the accounts. And then when we add on the accounts, we're up at a level where I don't think anybody is willing to see that level of benefit cuts or tax increases happen so quickly that draining the money from the trust fund doesn't put future benefits at risk.
Jack Beatty, we'll get your 2 cents right after the break. Peter Diamond, will get the details of what you're putting on the table. Last week we talked with Robert Posen. He's put out a plan. Peter Diamond and Peter Orszag have an alternative vision. We'll hear it tonight. You can join the conversation. Are you tuning in yet to the details? Do you see how they matter? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about another prescription for Social Security reform. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your priority in a Social Security fix? Is it protecting benefits, avoiding tax hikes, private accounts, means testing? Where do you come down? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by economist Peter Diamond, Institute professor at MIT. He, along with Peter Orszag at the Brookings Institution, have put out a fully fleshed out alternative to the plan that President Bush is talking about, the plan that really came from Robert Posen, investment executive who we spoke with last week. Peter Diamond is with us tonight. Jack Beatty is with us as well. We're going to get the details of Peter Diamond's, at least the outline of his plan, in just a moment here. But Jack Beatty, first, your sense of the moment we are at in this debate over Social Security.
Well, I think the president has really raised some very important questions here in the privatization debate. Three of them. One is heritability. I've noticed in groups of people when he's talking to them and he says, you know, when you die, you don't leave your Social Security benefits to your children. It just there's no wealth that's passed on. And people nod and they think, well, yeah, that doesn't seem right. Of course, it's a social insurance program. It's not an investment program. But I think the Democrats or any effort to meet the president halfway should say, you know, there's something to that. And maybe what we need is Social Security plus something outside of Social Security that would have the features the president wants of private accounts and that would be heritable. The second thing the president has raised that I think is very important is means testing. You also see people saying, gee whiz, Bill Gates gets Social Security and, you know, Paris. The point is they just get a sense that the rich are getting this benefit and they don't really need it and it's adding to the cost of the program. That's a very important consideration. But to deal with it the way the president wants to, by you know, cutting benefits sharply reduces political support for the program. A better idea is to look at income taxes or inheritance taxes as a way of saying, you know, you're right, they should pay more, and we should dedicate some revenue from the inheritance tax, say, to shoring up Social Security. And third, the president has raised a very important issue again and again. They will spend it. You can't trust Congress not to spend this money. So that's why a private account is better. They won't be able to take it away from you. That he's made a very good point there, and I think the Democrats can meet him partway, at least, by saying, you know, we have to take Social Security off budget. We have to put it in the lockbox. You're absolutely right, Mr. President. We've got to make it possible so that every person in this country will understand we're never going to touch this.
Mm. So there we've got three concerns from Jack Beatty, or 3 points in the president's plan. Let's keep those in mind if we can, Peter Diamond. And at the same time, keep the Posen plan in mind. And with all that, and we're counting on your expansive mind here to do it, walk us through what you're proposing within the context of these initiatives, of the Posen alternative. Give a sense of what you're putting on the table.
The way Peter and I approached this was that the fixes to Social Security should reflect the needs of Social Security and the history of Social Security. We didn't look for one big change to take care of things, but we identified a series of issues and came up with a fix for each of them.
Let me ask you one question before you dive in. There's debate over whether there's even a problem here. Democrats say there's no crisis, don't stampede us here. What's your operating assumption about whether or not there's a problem or a crisis in Social Security?
There is certainly no crisis. Let's put this in context. In 1977, the actuarial deficit was four times the size it is now, and the system was due to run out of money in 5 years. In 1983, the actuarial hole was about the same size it is now, and the system was due to run out of money in 2 months. Those are crises. This is not a crisis. It's a problem. What's absolutely right is the sooner we address it, the smaller the changes have to be to address it. But if we wait a couple of years, that's no big deal. Better a good plan delayed than a bad plan right away.
But you're saying, nevertheless, a problem to be addressed. How would you do it?
Well, we have a series of pieces, and I hope I don't lose all of your readers. I won't go into great detail, but I've got to do a bit.
Yep.
Everybody recognizes that we expect people to go on living longer, and people now are living longer than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also unpredictable how much longer people will live. Since Social Security pays a monthly benefit, if people live longer after retirement, it hurts the financial balance of the system. And so we think there ought to be automatic adjustments for life expectancy.
That is, if we live longer, retirement age would be later?
No.
Okay.
We don't mess with retirement age.
What do you mean then, adjustments?
The adjustments will come directly on benefits and on taxes. And the idea here is each year the Office of the Actuary would look at the improvement of mortality, would figure out how much the system is put in a further hole because of improved mortality, calculate what kind of benefit cut would wipe out that cost increase, and cut benefits for half that amount, and raise the payroll tax to cover the other half.
So that's interesting. You'd introduce an automatic governor in here, in a way, so that you wouldn't have to have the political debate every time to keep what's in the kitty in line with the increasing lifespan of the population, let's say.
That's absolutely right, because when we have something that's unpredictable and important for the finances of the system, mm-hmm. making automatic adjustments is the natural
way
to go.
That's interesting. Okay, so there's for starters.
The second thing, everybody's aware, we've had a big increase of earnings inequality since 1983,
mm-hmm.
and we've also had a big increase in inequality in life expectancy, with high earners having much more improvements in life expectancy than low earners.
Mm-hmm.
Based on that, we have two changes we'd want to make. About 6% of workers have earnings above the taxable maximum of $90,000.
Mm.
That used to add up to about 10% of earnings not taxed. Now it's 15. We would slowly, and I should say very slowly, push up the max subject to tax in order to get back halfway to where we were.
Up to what level? What would the cap be under your
opinion? It would only be up around 115 or so from where we are now.
And in 2005 dollars, and that by what year roughly?
Oh, it'll take 50 years to get there.
50 years. Okay, so a very slow rise in the cap.
We think it's a mistake for a program that should be moving slowly to suddenly change people's taxes. We think the changes need to be slow.
Very incremental. All right. So gradually, though, that cap would rise to maybe $115,000 over 50 years.
Right.
On which you'd pay the same 12.4% that people pay now or something
Absolutely. The same 12.4%, and what's more, you'd get a benefit increase because you had more earnings subject to tax.
But as I read you, that's not the end of it on the revenue increase side.
That is not, but why don't we stick with my sequence?
Okay. We're with you.
Because I'll come back to that, but it needs an introduction.
Good,
so let's
good.
Not
all
interrupt.
All right. So higher cap.
Higher cap. And the second thing is that since higher earners are living longer, that's hurt the cost of the system given the improvement in average life expectancy. It's concentrated on the people getting bigger benefits. And secondly, it makes the system less progressive on a lifetime basis.
Mm-hmm.
To address that, we'd slowly lower the upper part of the benefit formula. This would affect the top 15% of workers, and that would go slowly from 15% to 10%. And let me mention, this was also one of the pieces that came out of one of the plans from the commission appointed by President Bush.
So here's an element of means testing, though you're just targeting the top 10 or 15% of earners rather than a much broader swath that the Posen plan would target.
That's right, but I don't want to call it means testing.
Well, nobody does, but
usually
isn't that
when
what
we
it
say
is?
Means testing, we're looking at all of your income in terms of determining the level of Social Security benefits. Here we're saying we're going to make the benefit formula a little bit more progressive. We're going to lower your benefits if you have high benefits. We're not going to lower your benefits if you saved rather than not saving, or if you're past the age for full benefits.
But it's essentially
working.
Tied to income.
It's tied.
If you had more income, you're going to have a little bit a shave job on your benefits.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. You don't want to call it means testing, but there's an element clearly at play there. We got it.
It's aimed at progressivity. Mm-hmm. It's not looking outside Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Then the big part that's really innovative in what we do is we start out by pointing out something everybody knows, which is that our parents and grandparents got far more in Social Security benefits than could have been paid for by their taxes. And somebody has to pay that. Taking President Bush's statement that we don't want to hit anyone 55 or over, we've calculated that for everybody under 55, the Social Security Trust Fund is missing about $11.5 trillion in assets it would have had we not been generous to previous generations.
In other words, no generation paid its own way. It's always lean forward.
Recently, we started to swing toward paying your own way, but cumulatively, we're in that kind of hole.
All right.
So that has to be paid. And the issue is not, should it be paid, should it not be paid? We can't take back those past benefits.
Sure.
And nobody's proposing to take them away from the already retired now. The issue is, how do we spread that fairly across different workers in different cohorts?
How do you do it?
And we do it with three pieces. The first piece is that we want to make Social Security coverage universal by having all new state and local workers come into Social Security.
So they're not in it now. They're not paying
right
it out because they've got such a nice retirement.
Right now, three-quarters of state and local workers are in Social Security and one-quarter are out. And, of course, Massachusetts is a state with a very high percentage out.
And if you bring in that one quarter that's out, how big an impact does that have? Is that a big deal?
It will take care of 10% of the actuarial deficit.
Oh, that's a big chunk.
But it also speaks to fairness. The estimate is that about 3 percentage points of our 12.4 that we pay in Social Security taxes would have been covered by the interest on that $11.5 trillion if we had it. And that 3% that I'm paying and you're paying, we think everybody ought to be paying.
So all state and federal government workers in, and that
Federals are in already.
And that covers
state
another
local
chunk. All right, now, let's see. What's next
one
on your list?
Yeah. The second thing is, if we look at the problem of paying for the generosity to our parents, we think it's fairer to do that relative to total earnings and not just earnings up to the $90,000 cap.
Okay.
So we would put a 3% tax, just slightly larger than the Medicare tax, on all of the earnings above the cap, and that won't get you any benefits. It's a straight tax to spread more fairly the cost of what we did for our parents and grandparents.
So it would mean today it would be above 90, but you're talking in the future because you bring it in slowly. But eventually, everything I make or someone makes above $115,000, let's say, would have a 3% tax all the way up to the full earnings. That
all the way up to the full earnings.
That's a pretty significant new tax.
That is a significant new tax. It's a lot smaller than the tax cuts we've just had. It's focused on Social Security, and the American public has been very clear. The American public is willing to pay for Social Security, not only with the taxes of the rich, but with their own as well. The surveys are pretty clear on that.
Robert Posen says it's obvious that if you give high earners a choice between whether they want to protect their ultimate benefits or protect their current earnings, they're going to want to protect their current earnings from that tax bite, and you've got political problems built in here.
The problem with that is if you're cutting benefits, you're making the same benefit cut for somebody who makes $90,000, $900,000, or $9 million. If you put in a tax, you're saying the people who have such high earnings should bear a larger share of the cost of the generosity to our parents and grandparents.
I want to get to the heart of this because we don't have forever here, and I know these things are very detailed. The piece of the Posen plan that's attracted the most attention are the reduced benefits, according to the current schedule, that would hit the middle class. President Bush has taken to calling it the rich, but really we're talking, you know, sometimes down in the $30,000 and $40,000 and $50,000 range here. What would be under your plan there?
We do include some across the board cuts. That's the third piece of addressing the cost of the missing assets.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't start that until 2023 because we have the benefit cuts that were legislated in 1983 by increasing the age for full benefits, and that is fully in place in 2022. So starting in 2023, we would start some benefit cuts for everybody, just as we would sooner than that for increases in life expectancy.
So give me
that
a
will affect everybody.
Give me a number kind of in the middle of the earnings range, what the bite on future benefits would be in the Diamond Orzog plan versus the Robert Posen plan.
Well, if we take today's 25-year-old retiring in 2045,
okay,
and we take what's called the scaled medium earner, somebody earning just over $36,000 today, the Posen plan bite is 16% benefit cut.
Mm-hmm.
Our bite is 9%.
Okay. Is that a big deal? Between 9 and 16? Am I going to feel it when I'm huddled around my retirement campfire?
With two-thirds of the elderly relying for half or more of their income on Social Security, you can bet on it they will feel it. The 9% number, I should say, is less than the 10% number the 1983 compromise put on 25-year-olds back then.
Peter Diamond, stand by. I want to welcome you to our conversation. I know there's more we need to hear from you, but I want to begin to get a little analytical voice looking in on your program here. Joining us now from Washington is Maya McGinnis. She is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation, a Washington think tank. She was Social Security advisor to the McCain for President campaign. Maya McGinnis, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Maya, we just got a couple minutes before the break here, but you've been listening, and I'm sure you've paid attention to Peter Diamond's plan. We're talking about more revenues here, about some benefit cuts against the current schedule, but not as deep as President Bush has proposed in the Robert Posen plan. So that brings more cash in, still a trim on benefits, but not as deep. What do you think of the plan?
Well, I think the most important thing to emphasize is I think it's terrific that Peter Diamond and Peter Orszag have a plan. One of the problems that we have in this discussion right now is there aren't enough ideas on the table, and it's a really responsible and honest plan.
That's why we're here, because I think Americans are trying to figure out, even if politicians are bobbing and weaving, what do you make of this one, though?
I think that what you just pointed out, that the difference between a 9% benefit reduction and a 16% benefit reduction, in my mind, isn't that huge. Because when you get down to the real choices involved in reforming Social Security, which are what taxes are you going to raise by how much and what benefits are you going to reduce by how much,
right,
I think there's kind of a consensus about what makes sense in the real world, which is we need to reduce benefits because our entitlement programs, both Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, are growing at such a fast rate, they're squeezing out other areas of the budget. So you can't do this all on the tax-raising side. When it comes to reducing benefits, clearly it makes sense to reduce benefits for people who rely on Social Security less, not those who rely on it for all of their income.
But Peter Diamond might say, look, we're not cutting those middle-class benefits as deeply, and we're covering the whole deficit, whereas the progressive indexing Posen plan leaves a big hole unfilled. They're going to have to do something there.
That's right. Well, the criticisms I would have of Peter Diamond's plan are, one, that it probably relies on revenues more heavily than I would, because I really am worried about how many tax revenues we already need to balance the budget and fix Medicare. I think I'd rather do more of Social Security on the benefit reduction side than Peter Diamond and Peter Orszag do. And two, they phase in their changes very gradually, as you talked about in the discussion before.
Yes.
I'd actually like to see those changes made a lot sooner. We have known about the Social Security problem for years now, and as is often the case in the political environment, we've postponed and we've kind of kicked the can down the road from one administration to the next. It's time to make those changes, and it's not really fair to push those changes onto younger workers and future generations. So I'd like to see more of the changes phased in as quickly as possible.
So hurry up and do it. Now, Maya McGinnis, stand by if you would be kind enough in Washington, and Peter Diamond in the studio with me tonight. Jack Beatty, we've got to take a short break here. We're talking about another take on fixing up Social Security. You can join us. Is it time to let go of Social Security as a full umbrella for everyone? Time to see it as a safety net for the poor? What about Peter Diamond's proposal? Is this the way to go? This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about another prescription for Social Security reform. I'm joined in the studio by Peter Diamond. He's institute professor at MIT, a prominent economist there. He's testified before Congress on Social Security. He's come out, along with Peter Orszag at the Brookings Institution, with a plan that's getting very wide attention. It would raise more revenues than what the president is proposing, the so-called Robert Posen plan. It would cut benefits a bit less, a significant bit, he would say. Other differences here as well. You're hearing about them tonight. Maya McGinnis is with us as well. She's with the New America Foundation, a Washington think tank, and she's looking critically on, but also applauding the effort to get another plan out there on the table. It's time to talk about all this. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? $100,000 plus households. Would you rather pay more into Social Security or have fewer guaranteed benefits? And what is at stake in this whole Social Security debate? What was FDR's vision? What is George Bush's vision, his philosophy behind what he's proposing? What do you hear as Peter Diamond's operating vision? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Peter Diamond, first to you. You've heard Maya McGinnis. She says, all right, good on you for putting something out there. She's nervous, though, about raising these revenues. There's already a lot of claims on America's earnings. I think she may also be a little nervous that if you raise the revenues, Congress may do the same thing they've done in the past, not spend them on Social Security, even though that's what they're raised for. What do you think of her critique?
Well, first of all, I think we have to recognize that the Treasury was borrowing from Social Security, and of course the Treasury spent it. That's why it was borrowing from Social Security. But nobody is suggesting that that money won't come back and be used to pay for benefits. Second,
the money that you're proposing raising.
No. The money that has been raised, the $1.5 trillion that's in the Social Security Trust Fund, that's going to be used in the future for benefits.
But that's the lockbox that's empty.
Lockbox is a totally misleading term. The lockbox, when it was created, was to refer to the rest of the budget. The rest of the budget was in big deficits through the 80s and early 90s, was briefly in surplus, back in big deficits. Mm-hmm. But the Social Security Trust Fund bonds, everybody knows the federal government is going to deliver the money for it.
But they're just going to have to come up with the cash.
They're going to have to come up with the cash. Mm-hmm. And if instead of borrowing from Social Security, they had borrowed from you and me mm-hmm. and the Central Bank of Japan, they'd still have to come up with the cash.
So you're saying when we ask for revenues to cover that, don't even look at it as a Social Security fix. It's just a general obligation of the USA.
That's right. And as we look down the road, Social Security, which is in surplus now, will soon be going into deficit. Mm. So the people who say this money is being spent because they look at the unified budget and they say, oh, the deficit isn't so big, so we can spend more. Well, once Social Security's in deficit, If that logic is right, people will stop looking at Social Security. It won't be influencing things. Mm. So I see our problem is getting Social Security on track. And the polls of the American public are very clear. If you ask people, do you want to solve this problem by cutting benefits, solve it by raising taxes, or solve it by a mix of the two? A mix of the two when raising taxes wins hands down. Do it all by benefit cuts gets about 5% of the vote.
Maya, what do you say? What would you do differently? Are you on board with Robert Posen and President Bush's approach? Do you want private accounts in there?
A couple important points. I think that Bob Posen's plan is a very useful one because I think this idea of progressive benefit reductions should be really the key of any reform plan. Secondly, the one idea that I think is a very sensible idea that nobody's really put forward is raising the retirement age. I mean, we're living much, much longer than when the program began, and our life expectancy was actually less than you needed to be to qualify for benefits. So I think you should have something that reduces benefits and raises the retirement age and then uses some additional revenues. I do tend to agree with the president on the idea that individual accounts should be a part of the solution. But I do for a very different reason. I don't buy a lot of these arguments about inheritability, for instance, because you're going to have to annuitize what's in your account. There's really not going
to
be money.
And use it to live, yeah.
Exactly, to live off of it. What I do think, though, is that if we do, say, raise the payroll tax cap, which is a sensible idea, I worry about putting that money into trust funds. I would rather put it into individual accounts. Where I differ with the president is I don't think borrowing trillions of dollars to create individual accounts makes any sense at all.
How else do you do it?
Oh, you pay for it. You raise taxes and you reduce benefits more quickly than the Diamond or Zog plan. You phase those benefit reductions in quickly, and you use the savings that would create Social Security surpluses that are larger and last longer than the currently projected ones, and you use that money to put into and finance the individual accounts. And then you regulate them against risk, but it's a way to create that real lockbox. Mm. We were talking before about taking Social Security off budget. It already is off budget, and it hasn't worked, I don't believe, to actually strengthen the economy by saving the money for Social Security. So that's what I think we also need a fix for. Mm.
Jack Beattie, let me ask you here. The heart of the criticism of Posen's plan that's come up, apart from personal accounts, of course, that's highly charged. But what's been most discussed is the amount it would take out with this kind of means testing, progressive indexing, would take out of earners who are making $30,000 plus, $40,000, $50,000, maybe $60,000, hardly rich in America today. Even under Peter Diamond's plan, those people would see a significant reduction. Not as great. We're talking at one point here, 9% instead of 16%. Are you on board with that kind of cut for that part of the middle class, Jack?
I'm not, respectfully. I think that that Professor Diamond's plan accepts the given universe of tax cuts as they are. The last year, $89 billion went, I think, to the top 2% in tax cuts to the top 2% of earners. This year, $100 billion or so. As of 2009, if the president has his way, all inheritances, Bill Gates' $40 billion, will have no taxes attached to that. Their plan accepts that as the given reality. In other words, it isn't a debate about priorities. The priorities have been set by the president, and we'll deal with what's left. It seems to me the Democratic Party has a very good case here to talk about the priorities. And when you do that, you say, well, should we have the abolition of the inheritance tax, or should we use that money to shore up Social Security? Should we have the full tax cuts for people earning, say, I don't know, $300,000 a year or more, or should we curb that and dedicate that to Social Security? Paul Krugman says that if you repeal the Bush tax cuts, which no one is advocating, you could take care of, you would have need no benefit cuts, and you'd have $8 trillion into the bargain.
Peter Diamond, are you a prisoner of the given universe of Bush tax cuts?
When Peter and I sat down to write the book, our goal was to produce something that looked like the 1983 reform. And so we avoided things that were too far outside the box. But in the book, we called for preserving the estate tax and dedicating it to Social Security and offered that as an alternative. We didn't single out any particular change to be financed by it. But we certainly would love to see that happen.
And if that did happen, how big a difference would it make? For example, in the benefit cut that you've described here, would it significantly restore benefits, or is it still going to look marginal?
Reforming and keeping the estate tax would solve between a third and a quarter of the problem of Social Security.
That
means we could wipe out a lot of the benefit cuts, but certainly not all of them.
That's another big piece. Maya McGinnis, please, yes.
Yeah, just because I think this is an idea that's gotten a lot of attention, but it worries me because, for starters, the president's tax cuts have not been made permanent. And I would argue we can't afford to make them permanent. We have huge budget deficits, and were we to make those tax cuts permanent, we would still have to find all this money to finance the rest of the budget. We really can't think about making those tax cuts permanent because we need that money for general operations, and then we still have the Social Security problem.
Oh, that's fine to say, but everyone seems to be assuming that with the Republican majorities on Capitol Hill, they will be made permanent.
Well, I'm not sure we can assume what's going to happen with the tax cuts. I think the fiscal environment is going to be one that really gets bad over the next couple of years, and we may well have financial markets urging us to make more responsible decisions when it comes to the budget. But this whole argument of saying I'm going to assume that something is permanent and then repeal it and use the savings to fix the Social Security system, it's similar to saying I'm going to cut income taxes even more and then I'm going to repeal it and use that money to fix Medicare. It's kind of a double counting, and I don't think it's really addressing what we need to do to fix the problem.
Boy, the woods get dark and deep here, but we're trying to keep up with you all. I want to bring our callers in. Sarah is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was greatly relieved to hear someone bring up the tax cuts to the rich. I find it amazing that in our fiscal condition that we seem to think we don't need that money. And I would like very much to hear what would be the change to Social Security if we did add that money. I note that in the polls, the general public at the time that Bush was reelected didn't really grasp that those tax cuts to the rich were actually going to cost them. And I think the Democrats have a huge potential here.
So let me ask you something. Peter Diamond just said that if those were taken back, that it might solve a third to a quarter of the Social Security problem. Maya McGinnis says, don't assume that those tax cuts will be made permanent. You're out there, an American, watching what's going on. Do you think that Washington is likely to not make those tax cuts permanent?
I find it amazing that they ever existed.
But they're there, and you know what the politics are. Do you think they're really going to be turned around?
I think so. I think they'll have to be. I have one other thing to say.
Yes.
And that is, for those of you who don't know what life is like at the bottom of the heap, I'm on Social Security disability, and I live on $650 a month. That is a very small amount of money. When people start talking about cutting benefits, I would like to see them raise benefits for the bottom.
Let us pick that straight up. And Sarah, thank you very much for your call. Peter Diamond, I see you waving in there.
One of the elements in our plan is no cuts in aggregate in benefits for disabled workers and benefits for young children who lose a parent. We reorganize those to preserve the integration with the retirement benefits, but we would not cut. We would not save money. The Posen plan does do that. The president has
cuts disability payments
as scored by the Office of the Actuary.
It doesn't sound like Sarah's got much of a margin there at 600 and something a month.
The president apparently will not do that. And our plan also increases benefits for lifetime low earners and increases benefits for widows and widowers with low benefits. And there are a number of ways that we can have boosts down below, and I think that is needed.
Fred's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi. First time caller, long time listener.
Great to have you, Fred.
Okay. I think we need to go back to the beginning here and go with Paul Krugman's assertion that we need to look at the figures that this whole debate is based on. And like many people, I agree with Mr. Krugman that it may not be broken at all.
Do you really believe that? I mean, I know that there's a whole range of feelings about, is it a crisis or just a problem, but do you think, Fred, we can just sit back and do nothing, and you're willing to gamble on that?
No, I'm not saying do nothing.
Okay.
I'm saying look at the figures that the administration is basing its projections on.
Right.
They're bogus. They're a house of cards.
You think the hole's not as big and bad and ugly as they're suggesting?
Okay, I've tried to get news people and pundits to discuss this, but they uniformly tell me, oh, if we trot out all these figures, people's eyes will just glaze over.
Well, we'll trot them out right now, Fred. Let us try that on. Peter Diamond, here's a skeptic. And Paul Krugman's writing, hey, look, if we have the same kind of growth over the next 50 years we had over the last, there won't even be a problem here. So what's all the ballyhoo?
Well, first of all, the reason the Office of the Actuary is saying we won't have that same rate of growth is because we're quite confident we won't have the same labor force growth. So even if we get the same productivity growth, we won't have the same
GDP. The number of heads won't be growing the same.
That's right. The Office of the Actuary is regularly criticized for two of their assumptions. Some people say productivity will grow faster, and a different set of people say life expectancy is going to grow faster than they are saying. Each of those points in a different direction. Correct them both and you're back in the same place. The Congressional Budget Office is independent of the administration. They've come up with a set of estimates. They are indeed a bit better for the finances of Social Security than those coming from Social Security itself, but they still show Social Security running out of money. It's 2055 instead of 2041, but it's still running out of money.
So something to be done. I want to get one more caller here. Don's calling from Tony, Wisconsin. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Good evening. Thank you. Sure. I'd just like to applaud Peter Diamond and his presentation. I think the mainstream media has to hear some of this. The only concern that I have is it sounds so good and so detailed that it's going to be, you know, far too difficult for politicians to take hold of and try to get passed.
And yet it's all of our futures here, and the politicians' futures too, Don. I mean, yeah, Americans absolutely aren't that stupid. We can stand up and take it on board, can't we?
Absolutely. You know, I think, like I say, the mainstream media has to hear more of this. They keep talking about the president's plan and that the Democrats have no, you know, plan to come at them. I think they need to see some of these. The biggest one, and I'm one who is going to use my Social Security as a, you know, a good cushion.
You'll need it
with my investments and you know, my annuities and things like that. So I'm not totally dependent on it, like the woman who called before. But I'm in healthcare, and I see so many people who are dependent just on that Social Security check. Those are the low income people. We've got to take care of them.
And you don't think President Bush is saying, I will take care of the low-income people, but it's going to come out of the middle class and above.
I don't see that it's going to come out of the above. If we keep that salary cap at 90,000,
Who's really paying the freight? It won't be the rich, you're saying. Don, we're running low on time, but you're so good to call. Thanks for being with us. Peter Diamond?
The start of the benefit cuts with the Posen plan come at $20,000 in today's dollars. That's not middle class and upper middle class.
And
that's
remind us under your plan, they would start at what level?
Oh, we have them except for the people who are directly protected. We have some across the board cuts.
Yes.
But they're very small. Our plan does hit a little bit on people that the Posen plan would protect, but it starts cutting in. The progressivity that we did was focused on the top 15%. They focused it on the top 70%, different populations.
Miami Guinness, our time is short here. The Democrats don't want to put a plan on the table right now, but if they did eventually come around to this plan, does it look like one that could fly? Given your reservations, just politically, do you think Peter Diamond, Peter Orszag have something here that could fly?
I think so, as long as we can change the tone of the debate so that the country is willing to accept that this isn't about free lunches. We do have to make changes, and they're not going to be easy. So given the combination of tax increases and benefit cuts that's involved, the Diamond-Orszag plan is a reasonable one. I happen to think the progressive price indexing is a very reasonable one, along with lifting the retirement age. But as long as we can shift this discussion from what benefits we want to expand, you'll notice a lot of people called in and said, you know, we want benefits to be higher. I think that's what we all want. But given the real reality of what we face, it is a realistic package. And I think that Democrats or whoever's interested in this kind of a plan should start putting forth the Diamond-Orszag plan as a real proposal or an alternative if they prefer something else.
Jack Beatty, we've just got a few seconds here. Your crystal ball, where are things going to head? Toward Peter Diamond and Peter Orszag or Posen?
It depends upon whether the president wants a compromise or wants an issue.
Well, right now, he's got an issue, and it's going to be a hot one. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. Maya McGinnis in Washington and Peter Diamond with me in the studio. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Mm-hmm. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.